It's the Femme Fatale. I am your host, Leslie Gornstein. Sorry, not sorry, I was out last week. I was kind of busy fighting off an attack of a deadly head cold virus. Could have died. Not that you care. Before I was brought low by this 21st century Black Death, this Spanish lady of North America, I had promised you, my listeners, a few things. I had promised to follow up on a reader question about a Hollywood phenomenon called the blacklist, not to be confused with blacklisting during the McCarthy era. I promised that I would dissect the season finale of Game of Thrones with two of the most obsessive fans on Earth, and I promised you a new episode that would air the following day. Well, I'm delivering two-thirds of that promise, and given that I could have died, that's amazing news for America. The two obsessives I speak of, let me introduce them. Actress Shawn Serino, say hello.
Hi.
Hi. And Nerd Out podcast co-host Lisa B. Jenkins is back.
Greetings.
Hello. Now, in just a few moments, just a few moments, we're going to wax well-nigh nerdy about the big Game of Thrones finale, whether the absence of a certain fan favorite hurt the show or not, whether we even have a right to complain. I also have some celebrity sightings if I can fit them in. If I can't fit them in, we'll have to do them in the next podcast because the show is just jam-packed. And plus, of course, a reader question or two, which is the backbone of this podcast. But first, let me deliver on one of my promises. On my last episode, listener wrote in asking about something called the blacklist. It's a Hollywood phenomenon that this listener had heard about but didn't know anything about, only that it was somehow good and elite or something. And what is it? And why is something called the blacklist good? Because the 50s. So I gave a short answer in my last edition, but I promised I would go in depth on my next show. Now, of course, this was before my flirtation with death. So let me pick up on this. In short, there is a list that makes the rounds in Hollywood every year. Producers and script readers name the best scripts that they've read over the past year that, for whatever reason, were not put into production. That list is called the Blacklist, and ironically, it's a good thing to be on. King's Speech, Social Network, Juno. All of these movies were once scripts, and all of those scripts were once languishing on the blacklist for whatever reason before they went on to eventually get made and get famous. But the interesting tidbittery doesn't end there. Chances are very good that if you went to the movies this past month, you have seen a story that was once, for lack of a better term, blacklisted. So here's the Blacklist's founder, Franklin Leonard. Franklin Leonard, welcome to the Femme Fatale podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, no, thank you for being with me. Now, we've been discussing this now for the past 2 weeks. I touched on this in my last podcast, but I'm going to reread the reader question, the listener question, because I've got more questions for you.
Okay.
So Laura C. wrote to me via Facebook and said, Leslie, this is my question. Can you please explain the phenom of the blacklist that supposedly the best unproduced screenplays of the year end up on? How did this begin? What are some movies that we would know that came from this list? And why the name? I feel like blacklist generally implies that something is bad and we should stay the hell away from it. Curious. So I answered some of the basics on my podcast last week, but I want to give you the chance to put it in your own words first.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I'll try to do it in as succinct a version as possible. The annual blacklist is a list of Hollywood's most liked unproduced screenplays, and it's created every year by surveying now over 500 film executives that work at the major studios, major film financiers, and the production companies with deals therewith. It started in 2005, almost 10 years ago. When I was a junior executive at Leonardo DiCaprio's production company, Appian Way, and I was desperate to read some good scripts, having been frustrated by reading a number of mediocre to bad scripts throughout the year, and took a survey of my peers, asking them to send me a list of their 10 favorite scripts from that year that hadn't yet been produced as feature films that they had found out about that year. And in exchange, I would aggregate the information and send it back out. It was named the Blacklist, really to invert the assumption that your questioner had. You know, I'm African American and I grew up in the Deep South, and I remember being in middle school and being told about symbolism and imagery in literature, and, you know, particularly as it applies to color, You know, we were told with no real racial animus that, you know, if you see a cowboy with a white hat, that's probably the good guy. If you see a cowboy with a black hat, that's probably the bad guy. And white represented innocence and purity and heroism, and black represented the opposite of that. And even at a very early age, I did not like the where that was going inductively. I do look for ways to invert that assumption whenever possible. And so it was sort of fun, the idea of what if we created a blacklist that people wanted to be on. And it was also a nod to the blacklisted writers during the McCarthy era. I tend to be relatively progressive politically. And the idea that great storytellers of any stripe were prevented from being able to do that because of their political beliefs, regardless of that, those political beliefs, is sort of anathema to my worldview. You know, there have been about 700 scripts on the list. Actually, that's an overstatement. Probably closer to 500 to 600 scripts on the list in the first 8 years. You know, over 250 of them have been produced. Those movies have made over $20 billion in worldwide box office. They've won 30 Oscars. From I think almost 200 nominations, 3 of the last 6 best pictures, and I believe it's 7 of the last 14 screenwriting Oscars have been blacklist scripts, and that includes movies like Juno, Lars and the Real Girl, Argo, Slumdog Millionaire, Things We Lost in the Fire, and the list goes on and on and on, The King's Speech. And then about 20 months ago, we launched a website under the same name, The Blacklist, that allows anyone on earth to upload their script. They pay to have it hosted on the site, and they pay to have it evaluated by one of our readers, all of whom have worked for at least a year at a major Hollywood production company or agency or similar organization. And if the script is good, we tell the entire industry. And we've been helpful in getting dozens of writers represented at major agencies and management companies, and dozens of writers optioned to sell their scripts. And actually, the first film produced as a consequence of an introduction made via the Blacklist website will premiere at this year's Los Angeles Film Festival.
Really? Tell me more about that.
It's a film called Nightingale. It's a very low-budget indie starring David Oyelowo. He's actually the only actor in the film. It's a tour de force acting performance, sort of born of a really exciting script. And, you know, that script was submitted to the site, discovered by a producer via the site, cast up, and completed, I believe it was late last year, early this year. And yeah, it'll premiere at the Los Angeles Film Festival 2014. It's very exciting.
What I love is the irony of this, which is that all of these amazing scripts that were in some way or another passed on, they make the blacklist. And now all of a sudden, because of the attention of the blacklist, maybe they're getting a second life.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it's important for me to acknowledge that not all of the scripts that are on the list have necessarily been passed on. You know, the only real requirement for a script to be on the list is that they are beloved by a significant number of people in the industry. Now, some of those scripts may be things that everyone loves and are well on their way to production. A great example of this is The Social Network. Mm-hmm. Others of those scripts are scripts that were written by, you know, writers from Australia who are doing biopics of Jim Henson based on internet research they do from Sydney, Australia, as was the case for The Muppet Man, which was a script that ended up higher on the list that year than The Social Network did. What I think is really exciting about The Blacklist is that when you ask film executives to tell you what scripts they love, divorced from financial imperatives, divorced from concerns about what their boss is like, when you aggregate that information, it's a really eclectic list of, you know, great scripts by, you know, almost household names in the in and outside of the industry, and brand newcomers who are writing, you know, highly emotionally ambitious stories and weren't even represented at the beginning of the year in which they fall on the list.
Why do you think it is that so many of these stories are not immediately picked up? And then go on to maybe get picked up later.
Yeah, well, I think it's a few things. I think the first, a lot of these screenplays on their face are not commercial movies, given the conventional wisdom about what makes a movie commercial in Hollywood. So, I mean, take a movie like The King's Speech. You know, you have the story of a man who, with a stutter, and the climactic moment of that movie is that he gives a speech. On its face, that's not something that most people in Hollywood would say. That's got box office gold written all over it. And I think that, you know, that doesn't mean, though, that when a person reads it, that they're not emotionally moved and not compelled by the story. And they may even want to make it, but the economics of the industry makes it less of a no-brainer to make something like that than it does something like The Hunger Games, for example. So I think that those scripts that are, let's say, a little bit more emotionally ambitious and a little bit more on their face, difficult from a marketing standpoint, have a longer and more difficult road to the screen. But I think what's exciting about The Blacklist is that we're highlighting those scripts that are particularly well executed and in screenplay form inspire a very passionate reaction. And I suppose the theory is that if the script is doing that, and you can attract strong talent on the directing side, on the producing side, on the acting side, to further elevate or to further accentuate the qualities that the script has, then it's very possible for both the script to get made and for it to be successful commercially. And I think we've seen that time and time again.
Are there any movies that have come out maybe in the past month or two, or movies that are due out in the next month or two theatrically that we would recognize as being from The Blacklist?
The Fault in Our Stars. Most recently, I believe it was on the 2012 Blacklist. And this is the thing, again, you know, you take something like The Fault in Our Stars, which is on its face not the easiest thing to sell. It is a movie about a teenager with cancer. And you have a wildly popular book. You have exceptional execution of the screenplay by Scott Neustadter and Michael Weber. And you have great performances in the film, and you end up with a teen cancer movie that ends up making $48 million in its opening weekend. And I think that the reality is that, you know, audiences want high quality entertainment. They want to be moved emotionally. And I don't know a single person who's seen Fault in Our Stars who managed to get out of the theater without tearing up a little bit. So, you know, yeah, I think, again, it's yet another example of things that are on their face, not necessarily commercial, but when executed well with great talent on board, and let's be honest, great screenplays attract great directors and great actors. You have an opportunity for real financial success, and then everybody wins, including the audience.
I'm really surprised about that because the book was such a mega hit. I would have assumed that script would have been fast-tracked.
I think it was moving along well. I don't know the specifics of the process by which it was developed, but it's entirely possible that it could have been developed and made and not been successful because the movie wasn't good. I think it's a real credit to all the people involved, including the screenwriters, Scott Neustadter and Michael Weber, who've had a number of scripts on The Blacklist, and were the writers of 500 Days of Summer, which is sort of a cult classic at this point. When you do it well, and you have something like a book that is that popular, and I think John Green has done an amazing job with the sort of social media promotion of the book, you have an opportunity for real success. But again, you know, if you go back and even look at the press immediately prior to the release of the film, there were big questions around, can a teen cancer movie beat the big Tom Cruise action movie, Edge of Tomorrow, which I think was also on The Blacklist in its original form. But again, you know, and I think in both of those cases, they got really strong positive critical response and were financially successful. But you look at something like The Fault in Our Stars, you deliver on a good story. A good story, well told, with great performances and a great director, doing good work, you have an opportunity for massive financial upside.
Franklin Leonard, thank you so much for joining me on the Femme Fatale podcast. We will see you on The Blacklist.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we're back. Sean. Sean.
Yes.
Sean.
Yes.
Sean.
I'm right here.
Why don't you ask the first listener question of the week?
Marissa asks via the Femme Fatale website, I saw once the musical when it came through my town last month. There was a non-speaking child actor in it. Do these children tour with the production or are children chosen at each stop?
Now, they don't usually tour. And Sean, I want you to weigh in on this because you are a former child actor yourself. You're a former child, not a former actor. You're a former child, current actor,
yes,
who was also a child actor. Anyway, usually they don't tour. What I've learned is that it's too expensive to drag a child around the country with a merry band of bards and vagabonds. It's a non-speaking child. It's a non-speaking child. You could just swap those out. They're like, they're all the same. Yeah. They're all sort of the same height, and they all know exactly the same amount. You know, that you could swap them. They're just swap them out like Cabbage Patch Kids. But you, I mean, think about it. If you were to tour with them, you'd have to feed it 3 times a day. And if it's night, it needs a bed that you have to pay for. And its mom has to come, and she needs a bed you have to pay for. And it's not summer, so you have to educate it on the road. And that's money, people. Now, according to Tony Casala of the consultancy Children in Film, which helps stage moms and other people, friends of ambitious children, follow the rules when it comes to child actors, because there are rules. She tells me that, quote, the fast answer is yes. These small non-speaking roles are absolutely cast locally. It's very expensive to take minors on tour. It happens, but less frequently. It all depends on the size of the show and the importance of the character. I have not seen once, but I remember auditions in NYC for the tour last April. The young girl being cast had to sing, and auditions were for only New York locals. So, Sean, did you ever tour with a merry band of vagabonds?
No, I didn't. I tried, but I guess I wasn't vagabondy enough. But, I mean, I've been on stage, and I know that there's probably has something to do with, like, labor laws and things like that. That's probably very tricky to have a child come on board for the entire time.
Yeah, when you did go ahead.
Unless you're Oliver or Annie, or, like, you're central to the show, they probably want best to just switch them out, like you said.
Right, but if it's just, like, the third child on the left who pets Sandy and cries...
Right.
Then
yeah, why would you just get a new one? Yeah.
Just get a new one. They're in every city. You could just swap them out like Kleenex, right?
They're a dime a dozen.
They're a dime a dozen.
Kids, they're a dime a dozen.
Nobody sell children. Nobody who's listening, nobody sell children. That's not what we're saying. We're not saying sell children. So when you auditioned for shows, did you ever audition for a touring show?
I did not. It's usually musicals, and I wasn't really big into the musicals, although I understand that. I don't know. I'm sure for the children, too. It's a very kind of grueling process, you know, trying to do the song and the dance and the acting and everything, and then just the whole process of touring. It's, you know, and it's really hard for a child to do that because of the whole education thing, and, you know, they would really be able to do it summers, and that's about it. So... I could imagine it's really hard on kids and adults alike.
Yeah, you know,
it can be fun.
I'm of two minds about whether kids under the age of, say, 15 should be out touring and doing all that stuff at all, given how grueling it is. I mean,
in show business, period, I feel like it's really, you know.
Yeah, but if you're an adult, you're free to kill yourself. But if you're a kid, you're not really making your own decisions.
Right, exactly. I don't know many children that would want to do that on that type of a schedule. It'd be fun to do it once in a while, but to do it on that type of a schedule, where that's a crazy pace that you're working at, and there's a lot of hours involved. I don't know how many kids would sign up for that.
Anybody whose mom's last name is Jenner or Osborne or...
Exactly.
Or some sort of crazy freak Broadway child.
They all try to act like it's the kid's idea, though. I love it when people do that. So,
right.
Like, no,
oh, she wouldn't. She dragged me to these auditions. Was it always your idea to audition for these things, or did your parents basically bring you out to do these things?
I started acting, like, you know, in school and stuff like that from a young age. And so it was more just like a hobby. And then I didn't actually do it professionally until high school. And by that point, it was totally my own decision. They never were like, let's do this. I was always the one, which is why I'm not a household name today, you know?
so you blame the fact that you, right, you blame the fact that you were not a machine at age 6.
Right, exactly. If I was out here, you know, working my fingers to the bone at the age of 8, then, you know, I'd be J-Lo or something.
And you'd be completely you'd be not fucked up at all.
Oh, no, not at all. No drug problem, nothing, you know. No, I guess it's mostly drugs that kids get into with the child actors, but I'm sure there's a host of other issues that they have as well. Eating disorders, maybe?
The twerking.
Mm-hmm.
So,
although you don't need to be famous to have an eating disorder, you know.
Or a twerking
it's
disorder.
An equal opportunity.
This is true. Now.
It took a dark turn.
We got negative all of a sudden. All right, guys. Are we ready to finally wax forth on Game of Thrones?
Yes.
All right. Because, I mean, obviously I had a brush with death. I could have died, which is the only reason we're not doing this sooner. As a matter of fact, I'm going to go suck on a cough lozenge right now, and I'm going to do it in your face, because you know what? This cough lozenge could be the only thing between me and the sweet by and by. So you'll just deal with it. All right. So the finale happened. Arya's off to Braavos to, I guess, to become an assassin. And
spoiler alert.
What? No. I mean, obviously that's why they put, I mean, what do you mean? She said Valar Morghulis and she gave the coin, and that's what that means, isn't it? It's like your key to the killer school. Isn't that what that is?
I guess so. That's a good guess.
A good guess. She turned in the killer token.
It seems to me that
I feel like with these books, he could turn it any way he wants, I feel like.
All right.
Well, how about if we go with exactly what they said in the show, which is the coin is good for passage to Braavos. Right.
Oh, that's not what I thought when the assassin gave her that coin.
I didn't hear anything about her becoming an assassin in the actual dialogue.
I thought that token was get one assassin education free card.
I don't remember hearing anything about that, because being a book reader, I know that it's actually incredibly difficult to become a faceless man, which is what the guy who gave it to her is.
Oh, I thought
just get to show up and be all, here's a sword, like swing it around a few times and give it a couple of years and voila.
I just thought that the Braavosi coin was the equivalent of like, admit one to the faceless one school.
It's more of an admit one to VIP velvet rope access to Braavos.
All right. So do I get, she gets access to like the misters backstage, like a Coachella?
A little bit.
The good booze.
Yeah. She gets all access backstage.
Yeah. She's hanging with Jared Leto on the boat.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly.
So the absence of a certain fan favorite is being debated hotly on the intertubes.
I think it's safe to say that book readers were very disappointed that a certain plot development was not introduced in the finale. And many people, myself included, thought that it would come at the end of last season. And when that didn't happen, thought, well, surely it will be happening the next season. And gall darn it if it just didn't show up this season either.
Do you...
Right, it's like...
No, go ahead, Sean.
I was just going to say that it's not just one thing. It's an entire storyline that was throughout the entire third book that is just was not there at all. So it's baffling that they never even touched on it.
What would you have had to cut, though? I mean...
That's true.
There's a lot of other shenanigans going on there. A lot of death shenanigans, a lot of king killing shenanigans, a lot of dragon shenanigans, dragon-anigans.
Well, the one thing I'm having a hard time with this season especially is the addition of kind of superfluous stuff that wasn't in the books. And I feel like they're taking a lot of time, maybe stalling for whatever reason. And I feel like that time could have been used towards something that actually took place in the books.
So get rid of the Grey Worm love story. Put in this other, just like slip in this other gigantic plot point.
Well, I mean, there was other points in the, there was some long-winded stuff going on this season with some overwrought conversations that I felt like could have been cut down a little bit.
Yeah, but you got to remember that Peter Dinklage needs his Emmy. And if you don't give him four speeches per season, he doesn't get it.
Didn't he get one already? He's good, right?
Yeah, he did, but that doesn't mean he can't get it again. He's going to be competing with frickin'... Well, I guess you don't know. He's a guy, so he doesn't compete with Tatiana Maslany. But definitely the female actresses all need like as many speeches as they can get to compete with Tatiana Maslany over on Orphan Black.
That's true. That brings to mind one of the things that I do find overwrought is some of that Khaleesi stuff just gets a little bit repetitive. And I felt like they could have done with one or two less scenes of that. But, you know, that's just my opinion, obviously.
I also think that we are in a strange position as book fans because many of the storylines in the show are at or very close to where they end in the books. And so I will not even spoil it by saying who, but there are certain characters that, like, I could tell you, like, maybe a couple episodes ahead of what's going to happen for them, but beyond that, I don't know. So I wonder sometimes with the introduction of certain characters or the emphasis on certain plot lines, like, it's going to develop, like, a whole cottage industry of internet fans who are like, do you think that they included this person? Because that means that they're super important down the line. And I begin to wonder that myself.
You know, that's interesting.
I don't want to interrupt you. Go ahead.
It's interesting, though, that you said that certain people are almost all caught up plot-wise while others aren't. Maybe what that means is they're going to cut back on those other ones just so this deep plot point that you were talking about can get its full glory.
Yeah, and there is a big part of the, I think, fourth and fifth books are the Ironborn, which are Theon Greyjoy and Asha Greyjoy's peeps, who are like the terrible evil pirates of the island. And I've heard some speculation that maybe they're not going to have them really in the TV show at all. Although I feel like they've given both of them. Yeah. I feel like they've given both of them enough like love and attention that it makes sense, especially for her, because she's pretty minor in the book so far. So we'll see.
But their peeps pretty much take up most of, it's like half of the fourth book is dealing with the Ironborn.
Do they do anything?
And I feel like down the line, they're obviously set up to become like more major characters, but it hasn't happened yet. But there's so much set up in book four to some of the Ironborn that there's no way that they couldn't be somehow like, come when it comes down to it at the very end of it, they play a pivotal part. That's what I think. Don't you think so, Lisa?
Yeah, and I also think that the Ironborn are like the most bloodthirsty and terrifying of all of the different people.
More so than the Boltons?
No, I'd like to see the two of them go head to head just for indefinite amounts of time.
Maybe that's part of why you cut back on one or the other. I mean, when it comes to books are totally different from TV when it comes to delivering a story. You can only have so many assholes per TV show. In a book, you can have as many as you want. TV show, you really have to focus on, say, two heroes, two assholes, bunch of malingerers.
Yep.
So, you know, you're going to have malingerers like Peter Baelish and Varys and all those other people sort of lollygagging about. But then you're going to have... What?
Peter Baelish is not an asshole?
No, he's a malingerer.
Yeah, he's an asshole.
No. I mean, asshole. I'm talking about like a power asshole. Like you've got
he's
like two...
He's a gigantic power asshole.
No. Not as bad as, say, the entire Lannister army, an entire family of torturers, an entire ship full of pirates. I'm talking about like massive army enemy.
But see, that's what I think sets this series apart from all these other stories. It kind of turns all that on its head, where no one is really 100% good, and there are some people that are 100% bad, but there's so many different people doing so many different things trying to vie for power that you don't even know who to trust.
So you don't even know who the asshole is.
It's like everyone seems like they're an asshole.
The asshole is all the things. You don't even know who the good people are. You don't even know who the malingerers are.
Yeah, exactly. So there's, you know, I don't know. It's just, it's all so much. And one thing that Lisa kind of had me see the light, you know, when the season first started, and that the books, we kind of have to take them separately from the show because they're doing their own thing. And there's things that we don't even know yet that they're now writing into the plot line that hasn't happened in the books. And things that are happening in the show that never happened in the book. So it's like, it's almost like it's its own separate entity at this point.
So do fans have a right to complain about the lack of this big plot point?
I don't find it to be that huge of a deal if they're going to devote adequate time to it next season.
Lisa?
Yeah, I don't know the... I mean, I feel like that gets into weird territory. Like, do I have a right to complain that George R.R. Martin is taking as long as he feels like to write these damn books?
Oh, you, every minute you speak to me, you have no qualm about complaining about that every damn day.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, do I have a right to complain? Sure. Does anybody care? No. So So I think people can totally bitch and complain if they are unhappy about how things ended. But if they're so unhappy about it, then they can go write their own book and make their own awesome television series.
Exactly. Yeah. That makes me think of that list, Lisa, I think you told me about it, where it's like, here's all the things that George R. R. Martin is doing besides writing this book.
Yeah.
It's a list of like all the sites that he's editing, all the like book signings that he's going to. Like,
I think it's driving Lisa insane.
Yeah. Wherever he is right now, he's not writing this book.
No, and he's doing whatever it is in your face at you.
Oh, totally. At me. Yeah.
Sean, read the next question.
I will do that right now. Eva K. writes via the Femme Fatale website, please, Leslie.
What?
Can you please talk about or even write a book about Cannes Film Festival? I have so many questions, like, who pays for all the dresses, /hair, /makeup, /hotel, /meals of the actresses who are there promoting films? Do they have to pay themselves, or is it all paid for by the producers of the film? Also, according to the official website, the festival is for film insiders only. So why are there so many reality TV stars, musical quote-unquote talent, and general celebrities who have never been in a film that are being photographed on the red carpet?
All right. If you guys saw the red carpet photos from the recent Cannes opening ceremony, it's very obvious that this listener is speaking of a single person. That person is 18-year-old Kendall Jenner. Kendall Jenner showed up on the red carpet for the opening ceremony of the Cannes Film Festival. Yes. And even the most simpering Jenner fans were like, we don't know how she got an invite, but she looks great! Well, this is what happened. When they say that Cannes is for film insiders only, that's a lie. Cannes is for film insiders and anybody else that the organizers feel like inviting. Let me repeat that. It's for film insiders and whoever the power mad organizers feel like inviting because it's their dog and pony show. For example, if you will look on the official Cannes website, you will notice something. And that is a list of what they call partners. Those are not partners. Those are sponsors. Those are people who give money so that the precious French can have their uber expensive fancy Cannes Film Festival next to the topless beach. Do you follow so far? Now, Now, one of those sponsors is Chopard. Chopard, the maker of watches and jewelry. They are a sponsor, which means that they are key to putting on the whole deal. Without Chopard and their like, there would be no Cannes Film Festival. So you can bet that they have their own list of people whom they get to invite onto the red carpet to promote their baubles and their shinies. And this year, they hired Kendall Jenner to be their brand ambassador. Because she's skinny and 18, and they want the, I think that Chopard wants that demographic. They want to start the teens early on diamonds.
That they can't afford.
Get them nagging now for when graduation comes. And instead of asking for a nose job, you get diamond earrings. Do you capisci so far?
Oh, my goodness.
It's your bat mitzvah. What do you want? You want a nose job or do you want Chopard? Boom! It's evil. Right. It's evil genius. So, she shows up on the red carpet with diamond stack rings, courtesy of Chopard. That's why she was there. So, she did get invited. It wasn't like she crashed. But she was a guest of one of the sponsors who are just as important, if not more important, to these kinds of shows than, say, Nicole Kidman, who was playing Grace Kelly poorly. Does that answer that question? I think it does.
I think it does, too. It's kind of sad. Like everything else, Cannes is for sale, and it's more about the corporate kind of flat-handing than it is the art.
Oh, and speaking of money, who pays for all the dresses, hair, makeup, hotels, meals of the actresses who are there promoting films? Not the actresses. Usually it's the studio or the distributor or the producer who does it. The actors probably don't pay for a single thing. As a matter of fact, nobody may be paying for the dresses, actually, because many of the dresses are probably loaners.
Well, they do it for the publicity.
Right. So. It's to promote a film. So The actor themselves.
No, the designers also lend out their dresses to
The publicity, right? Yeah. And usually it's stuff that's just off the runway that isn't even available for sale yet. It's pre-fall, it's pre-winter at this point, whatever.
I have a question, Leslie. You probably know the answer.
I'm really sick and I almost died. So if I can't answer it, that's my reason.
I am a famous celebrity and I have a loner dress from like Lagerfeld or some Chloe or something fancy.
Good for you, sweetheart. You enjoy that loner.
I go out and get wasted and spill like red wine and trip and fall and roll around in the gutter. Do I have to pay for this dress?
Somebody does. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Probably. Here's the exception. If you are Angelina Jolie, if you are Jennifer Lawrence, if you are Shailene Woodley, if you are one of the it girls right now, like the 12 Years a Slave, Lupita Nyong'o. If people are so hot to dress you and only you right now, they may just sort of go, oh, that's okay. We'll just, it was just so nice to have you to meet Ms. Jolie.
So you're saying I should be careful as I wear this dress.
Unless you are top tier, what, did you get lended a Lagerfeld and didn't tell me?
Yeah.
Bitch.
Wow. Don't be jelly.
Yeah. Usually you are, yeah, when you have to return it, you know, you are sort of responsible for damage to the dress or things like that. But then again, the houses won't really loan out their most amazeballs pieces to you from their vaults. Like, you're not going to get like Chanel vault unless you're Julia Roberts anyway. So, and they're not going to lend like a middling C-list actress such as yourself anything terribly valuable. I'm sorry. Did I lose you?
Well, they seem to have no problem lending them.
Pardon.
They have no problem lending them to whatever her name is, Jenner.
Yes, but she's also not really known as getting wasted and getting coked out and rolling around in a gutter in the Chanel she was wearing. So, yeah.
Luckily, I've avoided that reputation as well.
So then there shouldn't be a problem, Ms. Jenkins. You enjoy that Lagerfeld and return it promptly and make sure it doesn't stink when you send it back.
Yeah, no sweat, no pit stains.
No pit stains, no essential oils. Got it?
Got it.
All right. Well, this has been another edition of my show. I did promise that I did have some celebrity sightings, and they are actually really juicy, but we have run out of time. So I want to thank actress Shawn Serino. Shawn.
Thank you.
If anybody wants to reach you to discuss how amazing you are, how do people reach you?
You can follow me on Twitter at Shawn Serino, S-E-A-N-S-E-R-I-N-O. That's probably the best thing to do, right?
Sure. Lisa.
Was that the question?
That's the question.
Oh, okay.
That was very well done. Lisa.
Yeah.
How can people learn more about you and the Nerd Out?
They can go to our website, thenerdout.com. They can follow us at The Nerd Out, and we have a Facebook page, all of which we invite the boys and girls of the world to come and nerd out with us.
That was really generous of me to recommend another podcast on my time. When you come this close to death and you actually look death in the face and you step with one foot into heaven, you realize what's important in life, and what's important in life is sharing, Lisa.
Thanks. It's caring.
Aww. It's caring. And by the way, if people want to welcome me back from the edge of the abyss, they can do so via writing to me via email at leslie@thefamefatale.com. They can tweet me at famefatalesays. Find me on Facebook or Tumblr. I have no idea why I have a profile there or Google+, but they are there. Or you can go back to the original website where it all began at www.thefamefatale.com. This has been another scintillating episode. We will talk to you next week.